Hi, I'm Susie Amos Cameron. I'm a global visionary for UBS, and I just finished a podcast with Mitch Slater for Financially Speaking, and we had so much fun. So please tune in, and I look forward to speaking with you.
Well, thank you for joining me today on Financially Speaking. My name is Mitch Slater. I'm a Senior Vice President and Financial Advisor with UBS Wealth Management in Westfield, New Jersey. Where along with my partners, Ann and Crystal, we do our best to bring you advice beyond investing and address our clients' most challenging financial needs. It's my sincere hope that each and every episode of this podcast will educate you on personal finance and real-life business issues of the day. So let's jump right in.
Hey, this is Mitch Slater. Welcome to Financially Speaking. I am so stoked to bring you this episode and let you know that I had some oat milk this morning. Now, why is that important? Well, let me tell you. Our guest is Susie Amos Cameron, who has been inspiring green behavior. She is a UBS global visionary whose mission is to ensure all children have a thriving planet to live on. Now, you may know Susie as the granddaughter in Titanic, a wonderful actress in many other films, a model for many years, but our focus today is on what she calls, in her book, the OMD plan, where you swap one meal a day to save your health and save the planet. I started with oat milk. Let's see what you will start with. It's really exciting. It's a genius idea. It's easy enough for even confirmed carnivores like me, and especially important now that we learn more about the profound negative effects of animal agriculture on our planet, not to mention the health advantages of cutting back on our consumption of meat and dairy. And she is changing behaviors, improving human and planetary health with a portfolio of organizations that are covering environmental advocacy, plant-based food, sustainable fashion, and education. We mentioned her book, but her passion for the environment has also led Susie, along with her sister, to found the Muse School in California in 2005, and now Muse Virtual, an online learning platform which opens the possibility of a Muse education to children everywhere. She was also the executive producer of The Game Changers, which was a documentary on world-class plant-based athletes. It's fantastic. It is mind-blowing. It's also on Netflix. In 2009, Susie launched Red Carpet Green Dress, a global sustainable fashion campaign showcasing environmentally responsible fashions on the red carpet in partnership with the Oscars. So sit back, enjoy the conversation. I was in New Jersey. Susie is in Auckland, New Zealand. She's been living there during COVID. They have a farm there. And of course, her husband is working on Avatar 2 and 3. But this episode is all about inspiring green behavior with my guest, Susie Amos Cameron. Enjoy the show and let me know, maybe tomorrow you'll have some oat milk too. Well, welcome, Susie, and thank you so much for joining us today from beautiful Auckland, New Zealand. I've been looking forward to speaking to you since you became one of our most inspiring UBS global visionaries for effecting incredible behavior change that involves food, fashion, and education, and most importantly, saving the health of our planet for all our children to grow up with it. And, you know, Earth is really my favorite planet, so I'm really glad you're out there doing this, if I had to choose a planet. It's hard to do these shows lately, though, without first checking in to see how you and your family are doing. I mean, this has been just an insane year. How's everybody, I guess, first thing?
Yeah, thank you for that. I'm really, really happy to be here. And yeah, I've been really looking forward to this as well. Our family's really good. We ended up, you know, along with everyone, I think everyone has certainly hit bumpy roads and worse. And we ended up kind of shifting gears and moving down to New Zealand. Jim's down here working and the children are in school down here. I can pretty much do my work from wherever, but I am excited about the moment that I get to, you know, be out in the world again. We feel really, really grateful to be here in New Zealand. The people are amazing. Air is beautiful. Water is beautiful. Mm-hmm. And there's no COVID.
No, they've been the shining star of COVID. I mean, from having obviously a wonderful president who she's just been amazing. And from day one, they've really been a shining star. So if there was a country that I could get to, it would be New Zealand. But it's kind of hard to get there.
Well, so we're lucky. We've had a farm down here since 2011 and immediately started working on our permanent residency. And, you know, and now are working towards our citizenship as well, which is really exciting. But that's, you know, basically the only reason why we were able to be here is we've been residents now for, I think, 6 years.
Oh, that's great. That's great. I much prefer that to be a resident of Florida where half my street went. I'm fine in New Jersey, although New Jersey's been crazy again, but we're all at least vaccinated. And I take care of my 94-year-old mom who lives about a mile from here, and she's vaccinated, doing great. So everything's good for now. So let's jump continents and talk briefly about you first, your personal journey, which, like all good stories, start in Oklahoma, where the waving wheat can sure smell sweet. You know, it's really interesting. I'm a former theater person and acted in my younger days. So, you know, I was just reading the lyrics of Oklahoma. What a plant-based song that is. And you really read the lyrics of it. You know, it's potatoes and tomatoes and wheat. And I don't know. I mean, maybe not quinoa, but, you know, anyway, did you grow up on a farm? What was your childhood like?
You know, we grew up in Oklahoma City, but we had a farm about an hour and a half south of Oklahoma City in the Arbuckle Mountains. So, and we spent tons of time down there. But I did not grow up in a plant-based world. I mean, you know, mom pushed, as I think every mom does, pushed vegetables and on us and things like that. But also, you know, you all need to eat your meat to be strong, and you need to drink your milk to have strong bones and all of that, just because that's what everybody was telling moms to do back then.
Sure. Madison Avenue has been telling people that for years and years, and everyone, my mom too. That's exactly what I heard. So we'll push forward a little bit. Age 16, your brother takes this wonderful photograph that kind of was your first game changer. So maybe tell us a little bit of the story of your Oklahoma fairy tale.
Yeah. So I was on a trajectory to become a vet. I had started riding horses, and I was really into that. The horse that I got was a crazy, you know, cutting horse, basically Western cutting horse. And all my girlfriends were riding English, you know, in these cute little saddles and little hats. And I asked my dad if I could get an English saddle and learn to ride English. And he basically said to me, I'll board your horse and I'll feed your horse and take care of the vet bills, but I am not going to be buying any little bitty saddle. So from there, I actually started, I was asked to do a fashion show actually with my sister, who we both looked a lot alike. We both had long red hair, and they called us the Amos twins. And we did this show, and I could make more money in 2 hours doing these fashion shows than I could in 6 months of babysitting, where I, you know, got 50 cents an hour for babysitting.
Right.
And I was like, oh, well, this works. This is cool. All the while studying, you know, to be hard and, you know, studying hard in my maths and sciences to go and be a vet. I wanted to take care of large animals. I wanted to take care of horses. I come from a long line of aviators. My dad taught me to fly when I was 15. So I had this huge dream of flying around, you know, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Louisiana, Texas, and, you know, being this flying vet. And, you know, but I was on my way, and it just took a complete 180, you know?
Yeah. Life has a way of doing that. As John Lennon wrote.
My brother took this picture of me, and the woman who used to book us for these modeling gigs sent the pictures to Eileen Ford in New York.
And
the next thing I knew, you know, Eileen wanted to meet me, and my mom was on the plane with me, and I really didn't have any aspirations. I just thought, oh, this is cool.
Sure, you're 16.
I've only been to Louisiana and Colorado and Texas a few times. I get to go to New York.
Right.
And We walked in, you know, both of us just ridiculously naive. My mom said to Eileen, well, it's been really nice meeting you. And we're going to go and we're going to meet John Casablanca at Elite and we're going to meet Wilhelmina. Mm-hmm. And Eileen said, this was after she told me I was a terrible model looking at my pictures. She told me to wait out in the hallway while she talked to my mom. And about 5 minutes later, they came back. You know, I came back in and they said, if you can stay for another 4 days, I'd like to take you on the Merv Griffin show with me as the face of the 80s. Mm. And it just, I mean, I was ridiculously shy.
Right.
I don't even think I said two words on that whole show. I kind of nodded my head.
For any millennials listening, that was the show to go on in late 1970s.
Yeah. So it was just this crazy, weird thing and an amazing opportunity. And, you know, from that, and this is something that, you know, speaking of millennials or young people out there or anyone really, I think everyone does have opportunities. They all look different, you know, but take them. You may get 2 weeks into it or a day into it and say, whoa, this is not for me at all. But at least you're able to turn back around and say, you know what, I tried that and it wasn't for me. Or I tried it and it led to XYZ, which exactly. is kind of, you know, what has happened with me. I mean, when I became a model, I became very serious about it and became a professional. And the same thing kind of happened with acting. I had an opportunity and then I decided that if I was going to be an actress, I wanted to do it 100% full force. Mm-hmm. Quit modeling cold turkey.
Right.
And I started studying with a woman from the actor studio. And I studied for about 2 years, very, very diligently before I really embarked on.
So you studied in New York at the actor studio.
I studied privately with Marilyn Freed, who was at the actor studio. But yes, sure. I was in New York.
No, I studied a little bit at HB back in... Oh, I guess it was early 80s. So it was Actors Studio was amazing. Yeah, really the place. And suddenly you're getting roles and you're getting these wonderful films. And all the while thinking,
I'm going to go back. And, I had spent 3.5 years based in Paris, traveling all over the place, learning French, meeting amazing people. All the while thinking, I'm going to go back to Oklahoma and become a vet. Mm-hmm. The closest I ever got to it, I played a vet in a movie.
That was my next question. You did get to play a vet in a movie. So, you know, at least you had that chance.
Yeah. And I got to do a lot of research. So I got to help, you know, clean a cat's teeth.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good.
It wasn't a large animal, but.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. To me, that's Oscar worthy playing a vet. I think that deserves awards. But obviously a wonderful, wonderful acting career while you were doing it. Did you think about the vet thing a lot while you were acting? Or was it just sort of, like you said, this just took you in that direction and here I go? Or was the vet thing always kind of in the back of your mind? Were you riding at the time or?
No, I wasn't. I didn't ride in New York. I started riding again. Once I actually quit acting and started having children, but no, I think probably about 3 years into it, into acting, I really realized it's like, yeah, you know, I'm really having a fun time out here.
Right.
And doing a lot of cool stuff.
Right.
And then I had my first child and, you know, that completely changes, you know, your
everything
about everything, which is really where the whole world started for me around the environment and what we're eating. And you have this beautiful, precious little child and, you know, even when it's in your belly, you're like, you don't want to eat anything that's going to harm the baby. Then it comes out and you don't want anything touching the baby that's going to hurt it. And
of course,
you know,
mama bear sets in and that's it. Right.
Unbelievable. Yeah. But I mean, this is where I think the millennials have done something. They've taken kind of a kernel of a movement and they've jettisoned it into our presence, which is something when I had Jesper, it was so difficult to find organic baby clothes. And my sister-in-law at the time had really taught me about, you know, everything you put on your skin or your hair, what you put in your body, you know, making sure you're eating organic, all of those things. I mean, I really learned those things. It would have been 32 years ago now. And it just was so challenging to find those things. Now they're everywhere.
Yeah. I think we literally bought some of, because my wife also wanted to find something organic, and with when our son was very young, I think we wound up buying some of it in Paris, of all places. Oh, yeah. But there were a couple places there that they went. So we're going to we'll just fast forward through the acting career. Everyone knows where it went. You met Jim, having kids, Titanic, all of that. So, all right, let's get to, and pardon the pun, but I just couldn't help but throw this out, the real beyond meat of what I want to talk to you about today. So I ran that by my wife, and she's last night, and she said, "Are you really? You're really going to say that?" I said, "Yeah, I wrote it." She said, "Yeah, okay. See how it goes over."
She's good usually luck right. To you, babe.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know. My brother and I are both punsters. We're like my grandfather, who lived to be 97, who was amazing and could have done the Catskills if he wanted. So anyway, what was your aha moment, though, that started this whole journey?
With plant-based eating?
Yeah, with plant-based eating. Sorry.
So I actually had a friend. He's founded schools all around the world. And he was a consultant with us at the school that I started with my sister, Muse School. He just went on and on and on about plant-based eating, and you got to watch forks over knives. And he was from Brooklyn.
Right.
And you got to watch forks over knives. And he kept on and on and on. And I'm a bit of a learning junkie. If somebody tells me to read a book or watch a movie, I get it. It might take me a while. I have stacks of them, but I eventually get to them. So I ordered forks over knives, and I chucked it in my shelf. Mm-hmm. And 9 months later, I'm on my way to the gym, and I thought, you know what? I'm going to watch that movie today. And I grabbed it, and I put it in the DVD, got on the treadmill, you know, started going.
Right.
And about 10 minutes into it, I literally had to get off of the treadmill. I felt betrayed. I felt like I had been lied to my whole life about what was healthy and good. And going through being a model and an actress, and, you know, it's all about whether you fit in the clothes or not, and, right, you know, how you're looking, and, you know, all of those lovely things. And, you know, it was always confusing. It's like, what are you supposed to eat? Are you supposed to eat a lot of yogurt? You know, are you supposed to eat a lot of meat? Are you supposed to not eat any of those things? I mean, it was just really confusing, and there wasn't science behind it. Forks over knives absolutely flipped everything on its ear. It's based in science. It's based on a 40-year research project called the China Study that Colin Campbell did in China. And it's, I don't know, it just was mind-blowing. So, and, you know, Jim and I have been having a lot of conversations about health. I have heart disease and cancer on my side of the family. He has heart disease and cancer on his side of the family. There's diabetes kind of like popped around in there.
Right.
Places. And we both started talking about it. You know, our doctors had said, well, you've got the family history. You know, you might want to start thinking about taking some things prophylactically. And I just kept saying, no, there has to be something there. And I've always kind of gone back to food, you know, that, you know, if the kids get a, you know, a rash on their arm, it's like, okay, what have you been eating? Oh, mom, come on. It's not what I've been eating. I probably, you know, anyway, so I watched that and I thought, you know what, Jim has to watch this. And
Hopefully you didn't make him get on a treadmill to watch it. I can't imagine having rewatched it now recently, being on a treadmill watching that, because that's just, you're just sitting there like this the whole time, just frozen.
Yeah.
You know, just like mind blown.
Yeah, yeah. I had to get off.
Yeah.
And anyway, I went up to the house and I said to Jim, I said, look, tomorrow I need in an hour and a half of your time. He's like, oh, well, okay, where are we going? I said, we're not going to go anywhere. We're going to watch a movie. And he said, oh, cool. I love movies. What are we going to watch? And I said, I'm not going to tell you what we're going to watch. I just want to sit down and watch it. And then we'll talk about it afterwards. The whole time, my heart was just pounding because I just wanted it to affect him the way it had me. I already knew what I was going to do. We finished the movie from the TV room into the kitchen. By the time we got to the kitchen, he said, we shouldn't have any more animal products in the house. 24 hours later, the kitchen was completely cleaned out. We have goats up at our ranch in California. Mm-hmm. And we used to get, goat yogurt and goat cheese.
Sure,
and goat
right.
Once
right.
a week. And it was, oh my God, it was so good. And we closed that production down within 48 hours.
Wow.
And we were off to the races. And then pretty much immediately got on our high horse, because within a week, you just start feeling better. I mean, it was like a light switch went off. I mean, there was one day when I walked in and I said, I'm sorry, this is going to sound really weird, but do colors look brighter to you? And he said, you know, yeah, there's this weird, like, clarity that happens. And anyway, we just went on our way, but we made these bags full of books and DVDs, you know, the China study and forks over knives, and wrote a long letter. We sent them out to our loved ones, and it, you know, the impact was like a ton of bricks, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And we were just up on our soapbox, you know, trying to tell people, no, you just got to do it. You just got to overnight, just, you know, cold turkey. You just got to do it. And it's going to make you feel great. You're going to have tons of energy, da, 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 you know? And, people would kind of see us coming and turn around and run away. What ended up happening from there was this school that I mentioned earlier that I started with my sister, it's an environmental school, starts at 2 years old and goes all the way through 18. It's all passion and interest-based learning. And, but there's a thread of sustainability through the whole thing. So after we went plant-based and Jim had been really educating me on the environmental impacts, which was another blow, which was another moment of like, you're kidding me. So wait a minute. I've been working with the largest environmental NGO in the United States, and I've learned about deforestation, ocean acidification, biodiversity loss, dead zones, you name it, whatever it is.
Right.
And nobody mentioned anything about animal agriculture.
I know.
There was a moment in one of those meetings where I just, you know, it's like where you have those, like, you know, bubbles up over your head.
Right, right.
And mine was like a flower. And in the middle of the flower was animal agriculture and all of the petals. There's an illustration of it in my book.
Yeah.
The petals were, you know, deforestation, biodiversity loss, dead zones, ocean acidity. I mean, all of those things that we know, because basically you can look at the majority of environmental issues and you can connect the dots back to animal agriculture. So I looked at my sister one day and I said, so we can't really keep calling ourselves an environmental school and be, you know, and keep serving animal products. So we got to go plant-based. And everybody was like, yeah, we can't do that. We'll lose all, you know, the whole school. So we took 18 months and had a speaker series. We had doctors, we had authors, we had climate scientists, we had athletes come in and talk to the children, the teachers. And then at nighttime, we'd invite the parents, give them beautiful plant-based food, a glass of wine, and teach them.
You made the case. You built the story.
We did. And you know, we had pamphlets. We gave out, you know, we had committees with the children, with the families. Anyway, fall of 15, we announced that we were the first plant-based school in the nation, 100% plant-based. And we lost 50% of our kids. And I just looked at my sister and I said, well, I think we just killed the school, but at least it was for a good reason.
Right. Right.
The good news is we quickly regained our enrollment and we surpassed it, you know, within.
You found a whole new group of people that got it.
Exactly.
And that's who you wanted there, really. So
yeah, exactly. So our community really changed in a really beautiful way. And what ended up happening one day is our head of school got very frustrated with the families and said, people, you can feed them what you want for breakfast and you can feed them what you want for dinner. It's one meal a day. It's OMD. So that's where the idea of OMD came from. So going from, you know, being up on our pedestal and not making any headway, you know, trying to tell people they just have to, like, you know, go vegan, basically, mm-hmm. to saying, look, just change one of your meals a day. Just start with that. And after working with the climate scientists that we did, the impact is enormous for one person. So it became empowering to a 10-year-old or an 8-year-old even. You know, one person changing one of their meals to a plant-based meal for 1 year saves 200,000 gallons of water and the carbon equivalent of driving from Los Angeles to New York. So while you can go and recycle, you can change your light bulbs, you can do those things, most people get paralyzed. Most people think, I can't afford an electric car. I can't put right. solar in. What can I do to really make a difference? Well, every single time you put food on your plate, every single time, if you're putting animal products on your plate, you're hurting your health and the environment. If you're putting plant-based food on your plate, you're helping your health and the environment. It's a simple, elegant.
It's really, that's the, yeah, exactly. And the book, and we'll talk about it later, but the book is The OMD Plan, Swap One Meal a Day to Save Your Health and Save the Planet. And the book itself is, you know, now I imagine in every language, it's been all over the world. It's now out in paperback. So it must be very rewarding that, you know, the book has done not just as well as it's done from the standpoint financially, but that there's so many people now that are, you know, have read this book and will continue to read this book, you know, and as I mentioned earlier, you know, we're going to talk about food, fashion, and education. We're starting with food. You mentioned the education, and you've really been the perfect tour guide into this subject. And what's so great about the book is that you really illustrated it with easy to read examples, how OMD begins to bend the curve on human and environmental health, as you mentioned. You really made it easy for those of us, and me included, who tend to make excuses or procrastinate to make any kind of change. But when you read something like this, that is, I mean, you couldn't have put it out there any simpler. And I mean that as a compliment, a major compliment. That's really what helps. So kind of walk our listeners that may not have read the book through some of your key points that you not only make, but you prove scientifically. It's in the book about plant-based eating, kind of the why, the way, the well, as you call it.
Yeah. So I was really, really lucky. I was able to work with a team of doctors for the health side of it, which the book starts out with looking at health, which was my original reason for, you know, diving into plant-based eating. It is since, I think, my focus is really about the environment, knowing just how much plant-based eating can help the environment as well. But it's like a silver bullet. It covers so many things. And I know that, you know, we talked earlier about game changers, which we can get into. Mm-hmm. But it, you know, whether you are going plant-based for your health or for the cute fuzzy animals or for the environment or for your waistline or in game changers for your sex life, you know, it doesn't really matter because it ticks all those boxes. Right, and now right. There's a sixth one, which I think everybody can connect to, and that has to do with disease. So 70 to 80% of all diseases are caused by the exploitation of animals. So if you look at SARS, if you look at anthrax, if you look at monkeypox, if you look at coronavirus, so pandemics can be eliminated if we quit exploiting animals to eat them. And I think that, you know, this is obviously the biggest piece that's just in our face right now,
right.
And,
of course,
and how
yeah.
it's, you know, devastating our so many things, from, you know, our families, our family life, our mental health, our economies, you know, so it's important to really look at those things. But if you go out and you look at just the health benefits of plant-based eating and starting with something as easy as just your energy, but the main, I think one of the biggest things that hit me after talking to these doctors is when you talk about family history, you know, people say, oh, well, you know, diabetes is in my family, or heart disease is in my family, or cancer's in my family. Well, in all reality, about maybe 5%, 4 to 5% of those diseases are actually really genetic and will really affect you no matter what you do or what you eat.
Right.
The majority of those diseases are caused from what we're eating, are caused from eating animal products. There have been, you know, multiple doctors, Dean Ornish, Neil Barnard, Esselstyn, who have reversed a lot of those diseases. They've proven that they can reverse them: cancers, diabetes, heart disease. So just that alone. And, you know, I don't know, people have said to me, well, that sounds so extreme to, you know, to be eating only plants. And people have this idea that you're only going to be eating, you know, salad and carrot sticks. And
right. You're not eating grass 24 hours.
You're not. We eat so many familiar things. I mean, we have pizza, we have burgers, right. Pastas, you know, all kinds of delicious things, lasagnas. But I think that one of the things that the doctors really, really said that was so impactful ultimately was that piece around being able to reverse different kinds of diseases just by what you're eating. And I've seen it happen. Mm-hmm. Friends that I've, you know, turned on to plant-based eating, and they were, you know, they've lost 50 pounds and gotten off of all their medications. And, you know, and this can happen very quickly, actually, which is, you know, there's a piece in Game Changers that they did a 7-day project with the firefighters, Rip Esselstyn did.
Right, right.
And seeing those numbers drop as dramatically as they did, you know, it's the proof is in the pudding.
Oh, it's right there. It's right there. Well, since you brought up Game Changers, anyone listening has not watched it, I'd be very surprised. It certainly was the number one downloaded documentary on iTunes. It's now top of the charts on Netflix. You and Jim were the executive producers for it. And I mean, it's absolutely mind-blowing watching these Olympic athletes, these record-breaking performers that, you know, you look up to, and you learn that they got this way being powered by a plant-first diet. I mean, that is, you know, as forks over knives, as earth-shattering that is, and learning, watching Game Changers for me was just like, wait a minute. And then you just keep bringing athlete after athlete, and then, you know, the testing and everything that you did. What was it that moved you to really get involved in the project? I mean, obviously, the plant-based eating, you were certainly all over. I mean, the sustainable side of it, which you talked about later, how food is the second leading cause of greenhouse gases and climate change, you know, could not be ignored. But what drove you to say, I got to be a part of this project? I mean, this is just right up my alley.
Well, number one, Rip Esselstyn is a good buddy of ours. And mm-hmm. you know, he came over to the house one day and just started pitching the idea. And I think that probably from that moment that I knew that I wanted to write a book and I wanted to, you know, get the message out there in any possible way that I could, I knew that I wanted to make documentaries and write books and, you know, create media that mm-hmm. is, you know, that is digestible.
Right.
And right. One of the biggest things after we've done so much market research in so many different areas, but one of our biggest things that we were hitting up against was the idea that men really felt like, and it, you go through it in Game Changers, because they have been targeted completely, that if you don't eat meat, you are not a man.
Right.
And if you don't eat meat, you are not like a manly man and a sexual man, and you know, and it's
absolutely- and in cinema, look at Rocky. I mean, you know,
exactly. But
well, he was punching the beef, but he was eating it too. So.
Right. But it's the antithesis. Well, we've got you know Arnold's in it talking about it. He was eating like, you know, but he, you know, we were the ones that we gave him that bag with forks over knives and all the books and all of that in there. And he's a big, you know, advocate for the environment as well. So he gets it.
Of course.
But I think just looking at, you know, the more and more research that kept coming out in terms of performance itself, whether it's mental performance, I started reading articles about CEOs around the world that were becoming plant-based so that they would have that mental edge, you know, the mental edge over, you know, being able to run their companies and that sort of thing. And physical performance, you know, athletic performance. I mean, I've had four kids. I'm in better shape than I've ever been in my life. I have a ridiculous amount of energy. Jim, like, is inexhaustible. I mean, he just goes and goes. He always had a lot of energy, but he just, it's like he's on steroids now. And seeing people, I mean, the strongest man in the world is in the movie.
Right.
He picks up a car and turns it over. And he's, all he eats is, you know, he's plant powered.
Yeah. I mean,
the heavyweight champion at the Olympics.
Right.
Plant based, you know, fastest runner in the world, plant based. I mean,
it's, you know, just who would have been, Muhammad Ali would have been a great spokesperson for it. He might not have at the time, but he was that kind of a person that would have figured it out. And he would have listened. And yeah. I mean, he's the greatest no matter what. He was always the first to tell us that. But I could just see him behind something like this when I was watching the boxing champion in the film. And my son boxes a little bit, and he boxed in college. And we talked a lot about that. And he said, yeah, that's why I do what I do.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think and of course, my favorite scene, of course, is the scene... is the scene with the three young men.
I know exactly where you're going.
Yeah. And because, you know, ultimately, if you have any kind of, I'm just going to go right there because I don't think a lot of men realize this, but if you have any kind of erectile dysfunction at all, typically men go to their urologist, but what they should be doing is running to their cardiologist, because men over 40 who have had, you know, erectile dysfunction issues have a chance, an 80% chance of having a cardiac event within 5 years. So it's something, you know, very serious to look at. You know, the very funny scene in the movie, and I won't say too much about it because you just got to watch it.
You just got to watch it happen. Yeah.
You just got to watch it.
Yeah.
But it's very funny and very compelling. And I know that they've taken, because it was just, you know, it was just one scene in a movie. And, but they're actually doing a whole rollout of a research project around it now.
Of course, that doesn't surprise me. One of the things that I've always been curious about and thought a lot about when I read the book, and because I'm, you know, the show's called Financially Speaking and we talk about things like this. What about the economics when it comes to being plant-based? I mean, have you found that, is it harder, is it easier for those who may, you know, need the most to struggle just to put food on the table? Will they find it more challenging, or it's absolutely the reverse of that, which is kind of where I'm heading, is that, you know, even the cost of healthcare, if you don't make a change, is clearly going to be a lot more than the asparagus at Whole Foods or wherever, you know. And I'm just curious, have you looked into that at all?
Yes, definitely. I think that's what, it's a huge thing. Jim and I actually, I had one lung thing that has happened, and I blame it mostly on the fires that were happening in California.
Sure.
And I think Jim has had one cold in 9 years. So May 7th.
Not to mention how many times he's been, you know, the bottom of the ocean and everything he's done with Avatar. I can't even imagine how he's not gotten more than one cold.
No, and you know, we are surrounded by, you know, not so much these days, but certainly before, you know, crowds and crowds of people of, you know, shaking hands and seeing people. But in terms, so yeah, it's your healthcare costs go down right away. And, you know, you're not paying for medications and all of those things. There is this idea that, you know, plant-based eating is this, you know, elitist kind of thing. But the bottom line is, and when you read the China study, they called it the peasant diet, right? Because, and in places like China, India, Brazil, you know, places like that, if you could put meat on your table, that meant you had, you could show your affluence that way. So so these diseases, heart disease, cancers, diabetes, you know, autoimmune issues, those are called diseases of affluence. So when they did the China study, the areas of China that were more affluent had more of these diseases. The peasants, you know, around in the rural areas who were eating, you know, soybeans and rice and, you know, and then in other countries where they were eating lentils, rice, you know, grains and things like that, they were not having these diseases at all. And a 5-pound bag of lentils, beans, rice, quinoa, you know, grains and legumes, grains and pulses, and the varieties of things that you can make out of those are actually, you know, a couple bucks a serving.
Right.
It's pretty, I actually did a lot of research around this and just ended up going on Amazon and finding all of the books that I could about, you know, eating vegan on the cheap and things like that for kids going off to college and how they could do it. And it's kind of extraordinary. People think, oh, well, I've got to go to Whole Foods and I've got to buy, you know, everything organic. You really don't. You go to a regular grocery store, you can get frozen vegetables, chopped up frozen vegetables,
right?
You know, and chuck them in a pan with some beans and some tomatoes. And, you know, next thing you know, you've got a beautiful stew that you can put over noodles or something.
Absolutely. No, that's exactly how I felt. I want to jump back to the education. We talked a little bit about the school. What was it that got you to create that school before the plant-based idea? Because it is so unique, the Muse School. Was this your sister? I think your sister's initial idea of starting the school.
Wasn't her idea.
Well, Rebecca called me and she said, no, okay. I got bad information. All right.
No. What happened was Jim and I have 5 children and the 2 older children had gone through we both brought a child to the marriage and they had gone through different educational systems.
Right.
And all of them, really, we had went through public school. We went through a private girls' school. My son was at the Lycée Français, mainly because it was the only school I could find that would allow him to travel with me.
Right.
And at the time, being a single mom, that was a convenient thing for me.
Sure.
But when we had our 3 children together and it became time for the oldest of those 3 to start kindergarten, I started looking around at schools and looked at, you know, how are they looking at the child as a whole? You know, how are they celebrating that child as an individual? And were they teaching them about the environment? How were they feeding them? You know, were they teaching them in a way that they could actually take the information in and learn it? I did not have a good experience in my, you know, early learning years. And I only felt like I really started learning when I left school. I really started reading and teaching myself. And I just kept looking around and I couldn't find anything. And I thought, you know what, maybe I'll just homeschool. Our oldest of those 3 of the 3 children, you know, is she's very much an introvert. And Jim and I just thought, you know what, she probably just needs some, you know, interaction with her other kids. And I thought, well, I'll just get some of the kids from some parents from the preschool and just start a little school, maybe in the guest house or something. And just, it was kind of goes back to that opportunity thing. One thing led to another. I called my sister up. So my sister, I'm a mom with, you know, a bunch of kids and big ideas. So I'm like, yeah, I'm going to just start a school. Had no idea what I was getting myself into. I called my sister, who actually has a master's in early childhood. And I asked her if she would start a school with me because she had started a facility, an early childhood facility in Wichita, Kansas, based in Reggio Emilia, which is child-led learning.
Right.
And she said, no. I said, come on. This is my younger sister. So I begged her for probably about 6 months. And I finally whittled her down and she was like, ah, okay, fine. So once we really made the commitment, the school that I had ultimately found for the kids, the older kids for high school, a fantastic school, the head of school said, you know what? I have a facility. It's one room. There's a kitchen and an area for a garden, and you can lease it if you want to. So all of a sudden we had the umbrella of their school,
right,
you know, and a facility. We opened with 11 children in 2006, fall of 2006. And right before COVID hit, we had two campuses and about 250 kids, you know, from 2 years old all the way through high school. We have since then, because of COVID, we pivoted very quickly.
Sure.
We had to. And we have become Muse Virtual. We are in talks of opening schools around the world when the time comes, Muse Global. Mm-hmm. But Muse Virtual ended up being this very unbelievably successful, very unusual situation because we had had a traveling program for about 10 years, mainly based on, you know, we started it because we were traveling with the children. So it was called Traveling Muse. And then we started attracting families, athletes, actors, you know, child actors, mm-hmm. diplomats, things like that, of families that traveled. And so when we closed the school on a Thursday afternoon and opened it fully virtual on Monday morning, and I started getting articles about, you know, how miserable people were with the online learning, the parents wanted to duct tape their children to chairs and the right. children were miserable and the right. teachers were miserable. Well, we weren't getting any of that.
No.
Yeah. No, our children.
You were so ahead of the curve. As someone who served two terms on our Board of Ed and talked about virtual all the time, and no one, you know, I said, we have to prepare for that. We have to prepare technology. We, you know, look at Khan Academy. I was just whatever was out there at the time. And mm-hmm. and it very, very hard to, in a town, at least where we are in New Jersey, to start convincing people of that. And at the end of the day, you know, you're offering coursework in theater and music and art and movement and cooking. You've developed these five pillars. Maybe talk about that just a little bit, because I think that kind of encapsulates really what the school's about.
Yeah. So, you know, the academics obviously is the most important in terms of actual learning. But I think looking beyond that, so we have self-efficacy, which is really, really important for children and for them to understand just what their strengths are and what they're capable of and how resilient they can be. So that's a big part of it. Communication, we use a communication tool called PCM, which is Process Communication Model. And it was created by a man named Tabby Kaler. He used it to choose the NASA astronauts. Bill Clinton and his whole administration was trained in it, except for Al Gore and Hillary. But that's why Bill Clinton won the presidency when he first did. When he came out of the podium and he went on his knee and he said, I feel your pain. He just opened up being able to speak to almost 45% of the demographic just by saying the word feel.
Right.
And they use it in Pixar movies too, mm-hmm. which is really cool, which sure. is why everybody loves Pixar movies.
Yeah.
But the how we use it at school, which is really great, is the children start to understand that they have different environmental preferences. They have different ways of understanding, taking in information or taking in different directives, whether you, you know, you want to be asked a question, whether you want to be told what to do, whether you want it to be sort of laissez-faire and more fun, using it in with your children, using it with your spouses and your friends is really an unbelievable tool. The other thing that happens with the children is, you know, in most schools, it's everybody's at a desk.
Right.
Everybody's meant to fit into a box. So we have some children that they learn best by being on their feet outside or sitting at a desk, very organized with, you know, writing lists and things like that, underneath a table, maybe with pillows and other friends. Maybe you've got one child that just needs to be completely alone and be reflective. So there are all these different, you know, personality types, environmental preferences. The other thing that it teaches is around psychological needs. So when the children become very aware of their distress sequences and what makes them, you know, anxious or agitated and what they can do to bring themselves back to focus, to be able to learn. And the teachers are all trained in this. A lot of the parents have seen such a value in it that they come in. We do trainings for parents.
I was going to ask if you do training for parents. That's great. I think that's wonderful and be great if, you know, one day that training is available online or something like that, because it's you're really teaching the secrets of life at a very early age. And I would add one thing, because financial education, this is just my plant-based learning is issue. It's not, I know plant-based learning, it's just my issue, is that we're I think 14th in the world now when it comes to financial education. And we've done absolutely nothing to improve. And I was part of a group that got at least in New Jersey high schools financial literacy for one semester. But as someone who deals with a lot of Gen Z and millennials that are in big company 401k plans or things like this, and you know, it's the same thing. They weren't taught at home. We go back to our generation. We go to the Donna Reed generation, where mom's vacuuming with pearls, and everyone's sitting down eating dinner at 6 o'clock. And you know, ironically, in that generation, my friend Neil Godfrey has written a lot of books on this subject. Talks about it was easier to talk about sex in the house than it was money. Money was just never done. And ironically, it still really isn't. And I don't know if you could sneak in some finance, just basic, you know, what is a budget? You know, well, just what is a retirement plan? Just little things. So let's pivot to fashion, because the red carpet green dress is also fascinating. And the stats that I just really blew me away, that fashion contributes 7% of greenhouse gas. What got you to start this incredible organization? And
you know, again, it was just this little idea, but I just kind of hit on a nerve that I didn't really realize was there. And it was 2008. So it actually kind of came from the school, because the school was a nonprofit and we were always looking for ways to fundraise. Mm-hmm. And it became very clear that Avatar was going to the Oscars.
Right.
I'd never been to the Oscars before, but what I did know, you know, from being in the fashion world, which ultimately being in the fashion world made me really not like fashion. The idea of it, the idea that it's, you know, you can wear one thing and be the coolest person in the whole wide world. And if you wear it 6 months later, you're, you know, and, you know, if you wait long enough. It was last 2 summers ago, I think, I found a bag of clothes that I had saved. And I pulled on these jeans, high-waisted skinny jeans, right? From the 80s.
Oh boy.
And I pulled them on and I went out into the living room with the kid and this kind of funny fluffy shirt. And I went out into the living room and the kids were like, "Oh mom, those jeans are dope." So if you wait long enough, you know, it comes around.
It comes back. Oh, yeah.
It comes back. But what we decided, what I wanted to do, because the school is an environmental school and it's all about sustainability. So we decided to create a global dress design contest where people would send in designs from all over the world with a small design fee, which added up really nicely, and that the winner would work with, you know, a seamstress to build the dress. And I was going to wear the dress to the Oscars because I knew that the first thing that would happen is they'd put the microphone into my face and ask me,
"What are you wearing?"
What I was wearing.
Right.
I could have said Yves Saint Laurent or Givenchy or whatever, but I wanted to have a story around it and I wanted to connect it back to sustainability and the school. So we did that. We had our winner. And we found Deb Scott, who won the Oscar for costume design for Titanic.
Right.
Who was going to build the dress. And I bumped into her about 3 days after we announced our winner. And she said, "I can't find fabric." I said, "What do you mean you can't find fabric?" I just thought it was going to be a no-brainer. Mm-hmm. I said, "What do you mean you can't find fabric?" And she said, "Well, I found this stuff called peace silk, but they use children to harvest the silk and they give them slingshots to kill the birds trying to eat the worms." And I was like, so it all of a sudden went from being an environmental issue to a social issue.
Right.
Anyway,
right.
She was able to find a company that didn't use children. So the dress is made of pea silk. And I just thought it was, I would, you know, probably do it once and just, you know, be done with it. But what I learned through that journey of making that one dress, I realized just how horrific the fashion industry is on our environment. And you just, you know, gave out the stat of 7% greenhouse gases. And it's number two, it's for pollution in the world.
Mm.
Yeah. So, and, you know, we... It's one of those things. It's like plant-based eating. The more you go down the rabbit hole, the more you peel off the layers of the onion, the more you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube.
Right.
So, you know, then I started learning about from my friend Jeff Garner, actually, who has a line called Prophetic. He started talking about the chemicals in clothing and how they are endocrine disruptors. And the main ones are the sporting clothes that we wear outside, you know. So if you're talking about board shorts or yoga pants, you know, these spandex things mm-hmm. that you wear outside, the sun hits them, breaks them down. Your skin is the largest organ on your body. It seeps into your skin. Yeah, there was a big controversy with Victoria's Secret many, many years ago about women getting breast cancer because of the, I forget the chemical that was in the bras, but yeah, getting chemicals, you know, getting breast cancer
sure.
from the chemicals in bras. So it's much more than, you know, just the, again, it's much more than just the environment. It's your health as well.
Of course, right.
So it's, and it goes kind of hand in glove with plant-based eating. It's like, what if you're paying attention to what you're putting in your body and on your body, you're going to help yourself and you're going to help the planet.
Yes, without a doubt. Is there going to be a virtual red carpet this year? I know you're in New Zealand, but...
You know, it's. I was actually just on the phone with Samata Pattison, who's my CEO of Red Carpet Green Dress. And it is... They're still kind of figuring it out.
Yeah.
They are. So it's it definitely will be a different kind of year.
Mm-hmm.
And but we're still gathering information and trying to figure out how to participate, because we do sure. participate, you know, with the Academy every year.
How can people lean in from their own homes when it comes to clothing and fashion in their lives and home? So for someone listening that really wants to do something about it themselves with their own clothes, any specific suggestions in that area?
Yeah.
Sounds like another documentary to be made, but.
Yeah. Well, there are a few out there that actually are pretty, pretty good, but yes, we're in the beginning stages of actually writing a book for about Red Carpet Green Dress and doing a show.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Great.
But and my kids are, which I love about it, because, you know, they don't want to go out and buy new clothes. And I think this is more peer pressure. I don't think it has anything to do with what mom does at all. But they just want to go to secondhand stores. And they come back home with the coolest clothes, you know. So doing something like that, I know that I've had friends that do clothing swaps. If you do want to buy something, I would say to really invest in it, buy something of great quality and take really good care of it. I have cashmere sweaters that I bought when I was 17 years old in Paris, and I still wear them. And they still look great because I've taken care of them for, you know, for such a long time. Levi's jeans, they last forever.
Forever. Yeah.
Forever. I mean, I have my jeans from high school.
Yep.
And I still wear them.
Yep.
You know, thanks to plant-based eating.
Exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was interesting as I was, before we wrap up, I just happened to see this story today, which just sort of really hit me because really has to do with the education for people of understanding, is that U.S. sales of plant-based products are actually outperforming animal products at like a staggering rate. I read a story that was just released in the last few days that 40% over 40% consuming non-dairy milk and 1 in 6 U.S. households are consuming plant-based meat. So like plant-based cheese grew by 42%, almost twice the rate of dairy cheese. And plant-based eggs grew 168%, like 10 times the rate. So, you know, there's a wealth of findings in these reports that are just astounding. And then you get a year like 2020 that happens. And I mean, you know, the total plant-based market value is something like $7 billion. So,
yeah.
You know, always trying to find silver linings with COVID. You know, we had our kids home. That was certainly our silver lining. But has COVID helped or hurt the mission? And, you know, and do you think the world's really learned anything? And I think you brought up such a big point by bringing up coronavirus and SARS and how, you know, maybe these things that come from animals can be avoided. But do you think the world's really learned something? I hope so.
From COVID.
Well, from COVID, you know, just in general, plant-based eating, is the pandemic a good or, that's kind of a strange question, but in many ways, the pandemic might have really helped plant-based eating.
I actually think so.
For our family, I think it increased it.
Yeah, because, you know, what we found as we were trying to figure out, a way to continue to interact with our followers and things like that is typically, you know, a pantry-based meal is going to be a plant-based meal for the most part. Yeah, you might use a can of sardines or a can of tuna or something like that. But for the most part, it's like, yeah, you want to make pasta. You grab your pasta sauce and your noodles and you make pasta. It was not that easy to get, you know, to be able to have constantly fresh food all of the time.
Right.
It was, you know, a lot of people had a real challenge around that. So I think, you know, so many people were home and cooking and trying new things as well. And the, you know, and you're mentioning the statistics, it is staggering.
Yeah.
Just how fast. I mean, it's when Jim and I first went plant-based, it was so challenging to find, you know, to find cheeses or to find, you know, any analog meats or anything like that. And it has just grown exponentially. And I would say even just in the last 2 to 3 years, you know, it's that hockey curve, you know, hockey.
Yeah. But we're in the early innings though, still. I mean, I really think we're very, very early innings. Yeah. And, you know, when you look at the statistic, and you mentioned it before, but it's just so important, I want to mention it again, that eating one meal a day, just one meal a day, 195 gallons of water, right? 772 pounds of carbon emissions. And I think you said the equivalent of going from New York to LA.
Yeah, that's one person for
that's
one
just
year.
One person for 1 year.
One person for 1 year. Yeah, it is. It's staggering.
It just absolutely is. So I want to end with a kind of a lightning round question that I ask all my guests. And I thank Tim Ferriss. He put this in Tribe of Mentors, and it's just such a great question. And you are such the wonderful, perfect person to ask this question to, because you already have a mission and a mission statement, but I'm going to ask it anyway. So you've been granted this giant billboard where you can send a message to the entire world. You know they're going to see it. What would it be and why?
It would absolutely be OMD. Just swap one meal a day to a plant-based meal, because it will help yourself. It will help the animals. It'll help the planet. It'll help your waistline. It'll help your sex life. It'll help pandemics. And most importantly, it will help the environment. And if we don't do something about the environment, it will not matter if we have sustainable clothing, electric cars, you know, solar power, sustainable school education. None of those things will matter. We have to take care of our mother earth. And this is one way that everybody can do something to make a difference.
Well, thank you, Susie Amos Cameron, who we are so proud again to have as one of our UBS Global Visionaries. And if I may quote Oprah during your wonderful interview, which everyone must see, by the way, giving us a path for all of us to dip our toes in. The book, to remind you again, in the OMD plan, Swap One Meal a Day to Save Your Health and Save the Planet, is, of course, available everywhere. We certainly will link to that and on the OMD website. And I'd like to end the episode of today's show using a quote from the opening of your book. As the author was some guy named Einstein, I don't know, not really sure who he is, but he could not have put it better. Nothing will benefit human health and increase chances for survival of life on Earth as much as the evolution to a vegetarian diet. And what I didn't know is how he became a vegetarian in the last few years of his life. I was just fascinated by that. Probably the smartest guy out there. So. Yep. It's not necessarily rocket science. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And as always, subscribing and sharing this episode. Thank you again, Susie. Have a great and healthy day.